Dear listeners, welcome to Giant Conversations number 5. And this time I didn't butcher the entire introduction. And hence we're here for the 5th time and our first real guest. So it's a bit different. I'm here with Joe from Giant Swarm, who actually knows Miles from Monzo. Hi, Miles. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Thank you. It's wonderful to have you. I'm really looking forward to this. So this will be a good one, but I need to cue our jingle first. It's to talk about Monzo, a big, big Kubernetes player, and we thought a good introduction to guests on our podcast. So maybe we start up. Maybe we actually start up. Joe, why don't you introduce yourself? Because you haven't been here yet.
Yeah, I'm replacing Tommy. Yeah. So that's why this episode's going to have no views, because Tommy's not here. Hi, I'm Joe. I work at Giant Swarm. I do engineering things there. I hate introducing myself. I live in London. I play too much Dungeons & Dragons. That's it. Miles, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Good point.
Hello, I'm Miles. And as Ollie already mentioned, I work at Monzo. I've been there for nearly 6 years working on... I mean, I think I've touched pretty much every part of our infrastructure and platform at some point. For better or worse, and but right now I mainly work on Kubernetes and our service mesh stuff. I'm also one of the hosts of Kubernetes London, the biggest Kubernetes meetup in London. We've got an event coming out in a couple of weeks.
So when do you have a date? When does everybody have to be where? Is it already clear?
That would be the 18th, if I remember correctly, and I really should be remembering correctly.
It is April the 18th.
Yeah. As one, good, good.
Very good. So you both will see each other on the 18th.
I won't be there, but I will recommend it to everyone.
Come on.
It's hilariously the same evening as Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Fair enough. But to start off, explain Monzo for us. Because, I mean, international audience, where is Monzo present? How big is Monzo? What does Monzo do?
Sure. So Monzo is a bank, mainly operating in the UK, but we also have a small US product. Joe, I believe you're a customer, which means I'm partially responsible for your money, which is maybe a scary thought for you. We've been operating about 8 or 9 years. A whole thing is to just make it easier for everyone to kind of work with their money. So like just providing a bunch of tools, nice sort of transaction views, budgeting. More recently brought in things like savings and investments. We just basically exist to make people's relationship with money a lot better, because I think banks in the UK traditionally not great.
Yeah. But that's the same thing everywhere. I mean, that's why these things
I
like
don't think
Monzo
it's just
exist.
A UK problem. Yeah.
And I do remember I did register with Monzo very, very early on to like, I am Germany, so if you ever come to me, never happened up till now. So theoretically, I am on your list. I can't be your customer, but I am on your list.
And Monzo Germany, let's go.
Yeah, well, I think the ambition is to definitely go kind of wider than the UK. Like I said, we've got a presence in the US, and I could see at some point, you know, us expanding further and further out.
Yeah, I'm keeping my fingers. What is it to say? How do you keep your fingers crossed? Like, isn't it fingers crossed in the UK like this? Because you press your thumbs
that works.
In Germany, so it's different. So I
wait in Germany, it's you press your thumbs.
I think. Daumen drücken, yes. In Germany, it's ich drücke die Daumen, dass das funktioniert. So I
Miles, 90% of my job is finding new German metaphors and trying to work out how they apply to my life.
That's why it just felt very weird pressing my thumbs and saying like I cross my
That's
fingers
so
and
weird.
Like no, that doesn't make sense. Okay, so you started 8 years ago. Like Kubernetes was already there, and we're obviously like this is the stuff we want to talk about. But like, did you start off with Kubernetes?
No, this is before my time. To be clear, I think our very very first version of our platform actually used Mesos, which was, yeah, sounded interesting. And the folks working on that had a bunch of challenges and thought, hey, Kubernetes, I think it was version 1.4 at that time. They went, hey, this looks better. Let's migrate across to this. And and of course, we're talking about I think 2016, something like that. Mm-hmm. And there's no cloud providers that offered Kubernetes at that time, or if they were, it was kind of incredibly early days. So I think the first engineers literally had to go, right, how do we run this thing? Like, how do we set it up? How do we kind of make it work for us? And we just migrated the entire bank across to it, and it worked, and is still working.
Okay. Wasn't there a lot of challenge, or is there still a lot of challenge like regulatory wise? I mean, are you on the cloud, or do you have your own like bare metal systems?
So we're 99.9% running in the cloud. And yes, that definitely was a challenge back in, I think, 2015, 2016. There was not a lot of, I think pretty much every financial institution in the UK and wider now runs at least some of their systems on the cloud. But that was not a thing in 2015, 2016. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing that we got a lot of pushback from kind of regulators. The cloud was, I guess it wasn't new in 2015, 2016, but it's still, you know.
For banks, it was.
Yeah, for financial institutions, we used to run in kind of massive data centers where they could kind of control everything. I think it was a very kind of new concept for the regulators. And, you know, I don't know if we were the first or if we were, I think we were one of the first, but there were probably a bunch of other like financial institutions also kind of pushing for this. But yeah, I'm definitely happy that you've been a part of that, moving everything to the cloud.
And I don't know if you talk about which clouds you're at, but are you using the Kubernetes of the cloud provider, or is there like special stuff you need to do to Kubernetes to make it like compliant?
So that's a really good question, because we've actually recently finished or almost finished migrating to AWS EKS as a kind of managed service. So as I said, you know, 8 years ago, no cloud providers providing Kubernetes, had to run it ourselves. And we still have a small sort of shell of a cluster running at the moment that we're still technically running ourselves. But we decided, I think, two and a half years ago that actually running Kubernetes ourselves is not kind of what we want to do long term. Now that there are many options for kind of managing it. I actually remember a conversation with you, Joe, I think about 4 or 5 years ago where we talked through this. And at the time I was like, yeah, right, running Kubernetes ourselves, great fun. Like, you know, I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah. I think I remember this conversation. It was outside in Liverpool Street somewhere. And something I remember like having that, a really long conversation with you about Monzo's infrastructure. And I don't think EKS was really super production used, because I think it was probably pre-pandemic, right?
Yeah, that's right. I think they'd literally just announced it.
Yeah, and I think we had a long conversation about in-place Kubernetes upgrades and doing them at a bank or something like this. That was interesting. Yeah,
yeah. Because the other thing, fun thing, right, is that we run one massive cluster, which again is not the long term kind of strategy. At some point, I think we will almost definitely split out and run slightly smaller clusters for kind of blast radius. But you kind of put this together and you look at the amount of work that has to go into an upgrade. We can do an upgrade kind of completely safely and well, but that takes a lot of time and investment in making sure it does go well. And it kind of got to the point where we're like, is this really work that is useful to us versus, building cool stuff on top of Kubernetes for our engineers or making it easier to use, et cetera, things like that. And
which resonates very well with us, which is exactly the same point we're talking about at Giant Swarm. Like that, there's
exactly
no Monzo will not get an award from customers saying, "Well, the way you ran Kubernetes was like amazing." I didn't get my money out, but I mean, the Kubernetes running was like top notch. But still, like you say, one big cluster, so that does everything. I swipe my card in a caching machine or in a kiosk and I want to look at my stuff and I want to invest something and so on, all running across Kubernetes. Or is there stuff that needs to be outside of Kubernetes for some reason?
Yeah, pretty much everything. 99% of the stuff. There is. I mentioned that we're 99.9% in the cloud. We have.
Yeah. What's the 0.1%, right?
We have. We have to have a couple of kind of data center presences for some of our payment schemes that we connect to.
Okay.
They are starting to come out with some more kind of cloud options for connecting to them. But again, when we started connecting to them, they basically. I mean, in sort of metaphorical terms, I guess. Give us a sort of physical network, you know, bit of fiber, and say, hey, plug this into your kind of system. We're like, you know, network fiber, physical, cloud, how do we do this? But we keep our kind of data center presences as small as possible.
Okay, so the data center presence is pretty much just because somebody else needs you to have a data center, because there needs to be a line in there, and that's why you have it.
Yep.
So you don't have it for some other regulatory whatever reason. That's interesting, because it really means that the entire thing runs in the cloud on Kubernetes, and hence it is possible. I will remember that whenever we talk to financial institutions, like, you can't run in the cloud. Yes, you can.
Feel free to give them a direct quote from me. Yeah.
Isn't there some UK regulation for banks on like system uptime or something like this? It's like, it's a newer thing. I feel like you might have told me about this once and I've forgotten it exists, Miles.
Yeah, maybe you're referring to the open banking.
Maybe uptime. I am. Yes, sure. What's that? So you have to have, like, as a sort of platform team, you actually have to have regulatory requirements for uptime, is what I mean, right?
Not in terms of enforcing uptime.
Okay.
There are other regulatory kind of concerns around if you have downtime that breaches certain criteria, like kind of length of outage or
like whether number of customers affected. Stuff. Yeah,
there are requirements for us to report that to the regulator within, you know, sort of hours, so they know what's going on. Mm-hmm. What I think you might be referring to, though, is the requirement to report uptime of our open banking API.
Okay, sure.
So open banking is a standard in the UK that all banks have to kind of adhere to, like a sort of API contract that allows other kind of companies to kind of connect to those banks and do read-only actions, like kind of see balances or transactions, or in some cases, like actually move money around. So it's how a lot of these integrations that work across many, many banks.
Yeah, like TrueLayer uses open banking, yeah. I understand. Yeah. I've gotten into open banking recently. It's great. I love it. Yeah.
Okay, so you kind of need to have APIs available as a bank so I can switch banks, use certain apps and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
And that needs to report uptime. Okay.
Yeah.
The unfortunate
thing is it's not actually kind of open in the sense that, you know, you or I as an engineer can actually go and use these APIs. You do have to register with the regulators as an institution to be able to kind of register for these APIs, which does make sense on some level because we're talking about quite sensitive.
It's financial.
But it does make me slightly sad that it's difficult, you know, as a sort of engineer to just go and use these APIs and build cool apps.
Do you have a similar thing? Like, I know in Germany, I'm pretty sure, no, obviously not 100%. I think the big thing for financial institutions here is that they need to be able to, or they need to write down an exit strategy of whichever cloud they use. So they need to be able to move somewhere else if needed. And is that kind of one of the reasons you chose Kubernetes? Because that means you can theoretically move somewhere else as long as it's a Kubernetes.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, we have the exact same requirement. So we have to be able to move out of our primary cloud into another region. That's something we worked on the past year, actually. I don't know if you were going to ask about this, Joe.
Well, I was just curious. Sorry, you said region there. Is that as in another region in the same cloud provider or a different cloud provider?
I think it's actually a different region in the same cloud provider.
Okay,
it might be at a whole cloud level as well, but I think we tried to tackle both. Because they're both sort of separate scenarios we need to be kind of concerned about, right?
So theoretically, I mean, we have that with some of our customers that say we're fine with availability zones, but we'd much rather have like two regions in the US. So if one region goes down or doesn't have servers or whatnot, we can move to the other region and move back and forth. We have that with another one that has on-premise data centers that kind of has like staging in one and production in the other, so they can theoretically switch over without running everything double. So interesting thoughts. But I mean, you already said big infrastructure. So how big is that infrastructure in whichever terms you can divulge? We talked before, like how many, like number of microservices that do stuff or even compute resources.
So I think I said 2,800 microservices and the cluster itself, I think we scaled up last week to 30,000 pods in a single cluster for one day.
Okay.
And maybe that doesn't kind of mean that much because individual pods can obviously be sized quite differently, but maybe that gives you an idea of the sort of complexity of platform we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. But 2,000, like, okay.
Hold on, I'm doing math quickly. So the Kubernetes max limit is like 110 pods per node. So 30,000 is 300 nodes? No, 3,000
nodes?
Yeah,
between, nodes? I think it was something like 500, 600 nodes, something like that.
That's a nice cluster. That's a nice cluster.
Nice cluster. Now all the cluster nerds go, oh, that's a nice cluster.
I think once you get into the hundreds, people go like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. Let's talk. Yeah.
It's not three nodes. Good.
Yeah.
But 2,800 microservices, I assume a lot of that is also just monitoring whatever supporting things, because I mean, but I'm always baffled with like how many services are running inside a company. I mean, that's 2,800 different ones.
Yes. Completely separate kind of modules of code. But I think the way to look at it, because, you know, I tell people this and they go, wow, that is so many. Like, how do you even come up with that many sort of different bits of code? But I think
sounds like, okay, we need another microservice.
We've got to get a conference talk in.
every engineer at Monzo has their quota. You know, you get to performance review times, like, you only wrote, you know, 75 services this year. You need to go to the magic
game promoted.
But no, seriously, I think when people look at that number and they compare it in their head to what they see, a sort of microservice, maybe something they've worked on at their own kind of company or talks they've seen, and they've seen like the service they work on being much bigger and sort of more complex. And I think for us, we've just set the boundary much smaller, right? Like, we've just modularized this code much more. So where in other companies, maybe you'd say that like the microservice boundary might be a whole sort of product service, like take something like savings, savings accounts, savings pots, as we call them in Monzo. And maybe in other companies might have a service that encompasses all of the logic that makes up that savings product. Mm-hmm. But in Monzo, we tend to subdivide those products much further and compose them into much, much smaller sort of microservices. So in the case of savings, you might have one that does the sort of more user-facing aspects, maybe have another one that calculates interest, maybe have another one that communicates with external partners, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. But is that also done so you can reuse stuff, like, putting money into an account is then used to put your money into a savings account or into the brokerage part or into the whatever part. It just moves money from account one to account B inside the company. Then there's another one saying you want to move to an external bank account. And so on and so forth. Yep. So it's modularized as much as possible.
Yeah. And my absolute favorite example of this is that we have a service that literally exists to tell you when UK bank holidays are. Bank holidays being days where obviously you don't accrue interest, or you know, has a bunch of different meanings depending on the product.
The bank goes on holiday. Yeah.
The bank literally goes on holiday.
The microservices stop running. I know.
Exactly. You know,
between... we just scale the cluster down.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it. And then you get into a circular dependency where the service itself is scaled down. But this service turned out to be really useful a couple of years ago when our beloved monarch Queen Elizabeth died, and we had a new bank holiday for her funeral and various coronations.
At quite short notice, yeah.
Yeah, at quite short notice, like a few weeks. And I could see this being really difficult in a number of places where you have bank holiday like logic baked in. Maybe you're using a library something like that, and you have to go and update a whole bunch of logic all over the system. But for us, we just made a code change to service.bankholiday, deployed it, and we were done.
Nice. Okay, that is nice, admittedly, and it kind of is the point of microservices to a certain extent. So that's, yeah, interesting. But so every team can fully deploy independently, I assume. How do you make sure these things all work together? Like we before the talk, we quickly touched upon like seamless upgrades. Fine. Then you just say everything that is there now, Kubernetes upgraded, needs to work the same way. But what about like people deploying and then these things all need to work together in the same, in the right version? How do you make sure that happens?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of the big challenges with microservices, right? Because in a more sort of monolithic code base or with bigger services, you can rely on your chosen language runtime compiler, whatever. So that if you change some inputs to another part of the system, like it will tell you that things are broken. But you don't get that for free with microservices, and it's something we have to kind of deal with. We use Protobuf to kind of define a sort of services contract and external facing API, mm-hmm. and then kind of generate the kind of language clients to actually make those requests. So instead of kind of services just using raw HTTP clients, they are kind of importing these generated clients, and that gives us some of the kind of compiler benefits, but it doesn't necessarily protect us from someone making a breaking change to a service and then deploying it, but not updating all of the other services that depend on it.
And do you have like a monolingual code base as well? Like, do you, I feel like I know you use Go, but I don't know if that's actually true. Like, do you have mostly stuff in the same language, or anyone can use, all teams can use whatever language and it's the RPCs that are the sort of the interface?
Yeah. It's an important point to mention actually. It's vast majority is Go in a sort of mono repo, hence why the compiler can catch issues where you changed a request parameter or something. We do have a little bit of stuff that's written in Python, two services that are written in Java for
two services.
Yeah, very, very interesting reasons.
There seems to be something special about them because he knows exactly that it's two.
It's the fact he said two, right? Some.
Well, you see, I'm in a team that does a lot of like infra and platform sort of migrations.
You're
right?
Running Java on Kubernetes, so, then. Yeah, that's
fine. So like the with generally with these migrations, like for 98% of the services, like the effort is sort of the same and the things we need to do are the same, but then you always find all the weird edge cases and things.
Sorry, we have to ask, why do you have two services randomly in Java? Out of 28 million, why do you have two that are in Java?
So I believe they use like specific client libraries that only exist in Java to talk to external APIs. Mm. It might be something about XML in there as well. I think they're sort of XML APIs and Java has better support for it, or did when we wrote the services.
Some external bank.
I haven't pondered it too much.
It's the worst API ever, and they only provide Java. Oh, wow, that sucks.
Who is running all those services? Is your team, or you and your teams and the SRE teams running everything and making sure everything is up, or do you have like Google style SRE contracts, whatever, if your service misbehaves three times, then you're getting back the pager? Or who has the pager? I mean,
I would say I'd call it more of a sort of DevOps model where teams are responsible for operating their services and their code. But only at the sort of code level. If there is an issue at the more infrastructure platform Kubernetes level, then it will be my team or one of the other platform teams who is responsible for getting paged and fixing it.
Okay, and then you can theoretically page specifically a team if needed, if there is something specific in code.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Because otherwise it's a lot of people with a lot of pages that get paged instantly with like to get the right person that kind of wrote the code and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I actually don't know how many engineers you are. I know Onzo's fairly big now. Yeah.
I vaguely know. I think it's 300 to 400, something like that.
300 to 400.
That's across kind of everything. So, backend, mobile, web.
Okay, so the platform team's like 20 people?
Yeah, something like that. Something 20, like that. 20, yeah, 30 okay. people. I mean, sure. Depends what you define as the platform teams. There are quite a
yeah,
few.
Where's the edge? Yeah.
We have, like, is the monitoring team part of the platform team? Is the whatever? Yeah, I know. Okay. What Joe tickered into the potential questions to ask is, you have quite a thick platform, and I have no clue what he means.
I think I can intro this a bit more. So I we can do a segue. Are you ready for this? So we're talking about, you know, running 2,800 microservices, but surely does that mean every team is writing Kubernetes YAML, or, you know, what's the actual interface that you're providing to these application teams? Ooh. Right? Yeah. See, thick platform.
Nice. I like it. Yeah, is every team writing Kubernetes YAML? Absolutely not. If we can help it, like Kubernetes. Kubernetes, as much as I love it, is not an interface designed for, you know, a sort of
humans.
Like, regular kind of backend engineer. Well, yeah, human, I guess, but also like a regular sort of backend engineer who just wants to write some code and ship it, right? Like, allows you to do very powerful things with infrastructure, but it also asks you to think about and define a lot of that bits of infrastructure. I think one of the advantages for us of having from almost day one, really, of having a very sort of thick platform and a very homogenous sort of tech stack where we're using a lot of the same technologies, is that we can very sort of narrowly define the tooling we want, make that tooling amazing, and then support that tooling and provide this layer on top of Kubernetes so that no one has to interact with it, which means that the actual manifest and YAML definition for every service are almost identical, and people never really need to change it unless they're doing something, you know, really weird. And then, you know, we might give them a bit of help, but they're mainly on their own and encouraged to use the existing features of our platform.
So, like, I guess application teams probably own, you don't have 2,800 teams, right? There's no bank holiday team. There's groups of teams that own some corresponding subset of services.
That's why they managed to change that so quickly. They have this bank holiday team that is sitting there, like, yeah, seven
there's,
people.
There's six people and just ready.
I've been ready waiting to for change that opportunity. Bank holiday.
I'm not going to make jokes about the Queen. So when they start like creating a new service, like, how do they actually do that? Like, is that like a, it's like a portal? I guess you're not really using Backstage. I guess it's sort of like a Monzo equivalent. And what do they get out of that? They get like a directory in the Mono repo, or and like a YAML they have to fill out, or sort of what's the sort of workflow look like? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a CLI tool, fairly similar to sort of things like Cookie Cutter, or things like that. Just template a new service out with all of the bits that you might need. So some sort of data access layer, like some example sort of RPC handlers and things like that. And then all you have to do is raise a PR and ship it to staging, and then that's your new service done.
That's really cool. And for like, see, are you guys ready for the next segue? Like, it's not a segue if I announce it, but this is going to be perfect. For sort of like cross service RPC, are you using like, do you have some queuing system, or it's some service mesh thing going on? Like, how are you sort of managing, or like, it's all just handled by Protobuf clients? Yeah.
We have a service mesh. So at the moment it goes over HTTP, but we use the abstraction of kind of RPC to sort of, you know, at some point in the future we could theoretically change it and, I don't know, use gRPC or something like that. But okay, that's a detail that's not too important to the kind of person using it. It should be almost kind of like calling a library. Then instead of just using raw HTTP, because one of the other challenges with microservices is that you have all of this stuff going over the network, right? So particularly when you have so many microservices, if someone opens the Monzo app, that initial call to kind of fetch all the data that sort of is hydrated in that screen, that might touch as many as, you know, 100, 200 microservices. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of kind of network calls. And I think something that people learn quite quickly with distributed systems is that the network is not 100% reliable, right? Even in this world of cloud, stuff goes wrong and requests go missing. So you have to have configure things like retries and timeouts and things that just generally make your services more resilient. And you could do that on a per service basis, but again, you know, that should be something that 99% of the time an engineer shouldn't have to like go and do every time or think really sort of explicitly about, because otherwise they might forget to do it or kind of configure.
You can move it to the platform. Yeah.
So having service mesh just allows us to do all of those things at the platform layer.
But you wrote your own service mesh.
Yes.
Because, I mean, by now you're probably happy with all the service meshes going like non-open source, but like, why did you do it back then?
Yeah, Mars, this is where you learn Ollie's questioning style. Because? Why?
I like it. It's a really good question. I actually did a talk on this topic at KCD UK last year.
Probably why it's in my head. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it's up on YouTube, unfortunately, but I can give you the sort of gist now. So similar to Kubernetes, the reason why we wrote around service mesh is initially because there wasn't a service mesh that existed. So I think many, many years ago, like back in 2015, 2016, again, before my time, but I did some interesting digging and archaeology and kind of speaking to those engineers. And we'd actually built something based on RabbitMQ for like sending messages between services, because queues give you a lot of like interesting properties that you kind of want for reliable communication between services, right? So you have natural sort of buffering and retries and also like back pressure if a kind of receiving service can't handle the amount of traffic. But we ran into a lot of problems, a mixture of, you know, not being able to operate RabbitMQ properly, and just a bunch of other things that we found really difficult with it. And at that point, we decided to adopt Linkerd, the first version of Linkerd. It worked great. I think at the point we adopted it, it didn't really have like a fully featured sort of control plane for configuring Linkerd. That was something we had to write ourselves, as sort of shim between the Kubernetes API and Linkerd. And then we switched over to Envoy a few years later, mainly for performance reasons. We were just finding that Linkerd one was just, because it's sort of JVM based, right? And it's quite a sort of heavy process.
That's where they rewrote the proxy for V2, right? Yeah.
It was really unfortunate timing, actually. I think if we'd done that a year later, we would have probably very, very seriously gone in on kind of Linkerd 2. But I think at the point we needed it to happen, it just wasn't quite ready, and it just wasn't quite there for us. So we switched over to Envoy. At this point, we already had a kind of existing service mesh with all of its kind of conventions and ways it kind of works, which is different from maybe other Envoy-based control planes. So we had to write our own control plane for that. But it was pretty simple at the time. Wasn't kind of too much work. And also I think Istio at that point, like we're up to 2019 now, I think. Istio at that point, not really something you'd want to kind of run a bank on, even maybe one as brave as us. I think at some point in the future, there will cross a sort of inflection point where writing our own service mesh doesn't make sense, and we kind of get to the point where we are just re-implementing something like Istio, and it makes more sense for us to just switch to something open source.
But now I need to jump in between with the guy that has no clue. Isn't Envoy a service mesh?
Envoy is a proxy. If I remember Mars's talk correctly, each pod or each node runs an Envoy proxy, and then Monzo has a microservice, because obviously, that talks with the Kubernetes API and then sends commands and messages to all these Envoy proxies. So as opposed to, like, I guess Contour would be like an alternative for sort of the Monzo microservice here. The Envoy works as a sort of proxy for all that traffic, and they build the sort of service mesh control plane because it's a better interaction for them, sort of for legacy reasons overall.
So most service meshes are kind of divided into data planes and control planes. So the data plane is the one actually kind of handling the requests and the traffic. But in order to know where to send that traffic, or, you know, how many retries to do, or how to handle failure, the data plane needs the control plane to be able to configure it. But I think, as you said, Joe, some service meshes combine both in one.
Well, I guess Istio uses Envoy as its proxy, right?
Yeah, exactly, sure. But has its own control plane implementation.
But you said you don't have, I think it was RabbitMQ or whatever anymore. Don't you need something like that in between? Like, if I send you money, you need to be pretty sure that I sent money and you received money, and both cases need to be true. Now that's spread across multiple microservices because I assume the sending money and the receiving money is two microservices, having understood Monzo. So how much logic needs to be in there to make sure that happens?
So I think we tackle this at a variety of layers, right? At the platform and the infrastructure level, we have no concept of like what the application is doing. Like, you know, we want it to work the same way for like someone transferring money as like some like trivial sort of back office process. So we look at it at the level of kind of HTTP and how we configure retries and like timeouts and a variety of other kind of techniques. At the application level, there are a variety of other techniques we use, like idempotency keys to make sure that we don't like kind of, you know, if you send a request to send someone money and that gets retried, you know, we don't want that ending up as multiple yeah. like requests to send money. We want it to be kind of one request to send money.
Okay. But that
and
means
I guess you probably have tons of like distributed locks and stuff. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And the application knows that it can retry because it's a standard way of retrying and how it can do that without doing duplicate spends and so on and so forth. So that's defined in the infrastructure, how a retry can happen. Okay. Yeah, and that's probably the same. Like, if I buy a stock, it's the same thing. If I transfer money, it's the same thing. If I get money off my card, it's the same. It's always the same retry logic,
whatever.
Well, I guess
it's the difference between, like, on the platform level, you essentially want to make sure HTTP messages on the whole reach their destination. But on the application level, it's, okay, and those messages describe updating ledgers and stuff like this. Sure.
Yeah.
Does that all need to, like, if I go to a supermarket and buy something and my card goes through the thing. I mean, isn't retried like has it done all its retries and confirmed that it deducted the money from my bank account when my swipe is clear, or does it cache things in the middle?
So normally the card network would actually be calling out to the bank to ask them to make a decision on whether to authorize the transaction. And then it's kind of up to the bank to implement that logic and say, you know, has this.
Oh, it's two different systems. Good point.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And the card thing says, okay, I give him the 500 pounds, whatever, because you have pounds.
Pounds? Love it.
Yeah. it kind of gives me the money, and then the card system knows that it needs to tell the bank that it took 500 pounds, but they will make sure that that happened independently of, like, they ask once, like, can you have it? And then the other process is another process. Interesting. Lots of like, it's interesting that it needs to be, like, you have a microservices system that needs to be very, very clear that stuff that happens really happens. Because, like, in e-commerce, also, if you buy the shoe, you should buy the shoe. But still, I know there are inventory issues with, like, one thing lists as inventory still there, the other doesn't, and suddenly the shoe isn't available or whatnot, you know, lots of stuff. But that can't happen on your end.
Yeah. And that's another kind of really interesting technique we use in quite a lot of Monzo, actually, is sort of reconciliation and coherence. Like, reconciliation from a financial perspective is obviously very important for a bank. Like, we need to make sure all the numbers add up and create that money, and, you know, there's not just some service bug somewhere that's, like, you know, triple credited someone and, you know, money's ended up in the wrong place. But I think we also use it in a sort of broader sense to say, has our system, like, is the state of our system in some kind of state that, you know, adds up or makes sense? So have all of the transactions, so, like, the supplies at a financial level, but I'm really struggling to think of an example that isn't financial. But
I think you've worked in a financial context for far too long at this point. Yeah, right? Yeah, like, exactly. Whenever I give examples, they're always like, okay, but imagine all the computers. Yeah, exactly.
I have two questions, and we're already longer.
We did it,
but it's fun.
We did
anyway,
it.
Anyway, I still have two questions, at least. One question, and you can just stay silent. if you can't or don't want to answer. Was there ever a bug where like money moved the wrong way? You kind of figured it out and moved it back the right way.
Oh, but there has to have been. Sorry, I don't believe that.
Absolutely.
Never happened.
Yeah. And yeah, this, I don't think, I can't remember the last time this happened at a very, very sort of major level. But it definitely happens like semi-frequently, like where our reconciliation processes have picked up that there's the wrong amount of money somewhere. Someone's gone and investigated and says, okay, this is why. It's not always due to us as well.
Do you have, forensic accountants? I guess there's a guy at Monzo whose job it is to go through and go like, well, hold on, this is the mistake.
Well, no, this is normally an engineer working on a team.
That sounds like such a great cool job.
Exactly.
Why does Monzo can be an engineer and a forensic accountant on his bank account?
But this is what I always assume that is the worst thing about being working at Monzo is anytime you ever tell anyone like, oh, I work at Monzo like as an engineer, they go like, oh, well, there's a bug. I don't seem to have enough money. Right. Everyone always makes that joke. Yeah. Like that's got to be every party you've ever been to. Yeah, sure.
But you know, it's also like that's counterbalanced for me by the fact I work on a product that lots of people use and earn a lot.
That is cool.
I'm fine with that kind of trade off.
Still fun. Fun questions to ask. But another question that came to my mind. So what kind of other big open source next to Kubernetes things from the community are you heavily relying on, if that is a sensible thing? I mean, we're always talking about Kubernetes, but what we've like Kubernetes by itself is starting to get really boring. Like there's always more around it. You must have security tooling in there or monitoring tooling in there or other things that where you just rely on open source.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in general, we try and rely on open source components, and this might be somewhere where we differ at least or did differ in kind of 2015, 2016 from a more traditional kind of financial institution in that we wanted to rely more on open source projects. Mm-hmm. Than say, you know, closed source sort of vendory things with support contracts. Because as engineers, open source is something we can go and inspect and see how it works and kind of tweak ourselves and kind of fix things ourselves. And that makes so much more sense. So I'd say most of our platform is built on open source technologies. The other big things that come to mind are Kafka as a key that we run ourselves, Prometheus for monitoring, along with Thanos as a sort of Prometheus aggregator. I think we were one of the like very, very first users of Thanos. I'm pretty sure we deployed version 0.01, which would be a scary thought now, but it did a great job at the time.
It's always that fun difference between when you're like starting up as a business and can just get away with anything and when you're an actual business and you have to think about things. Yeah, it's strange.
There are probably too many projects that we've ended up being the biggest users of. quite early on. I remember with the Kubernetes vertical pod autoscaler, actually, we deployed that sort of 2019 when it wasn't really like I guess it's just this kind of standard thing that's deployed in all clusters now. But I think back in 2019, it wasn't like not a lot of people were
Absolutely
really
not.
Using it.
Yeah.
And I remember running into some issues with using the sort of Prometheus integration that queries CPU metrics and things. And saying, you know, this query just isn't working for us because we've got too many pods. And I raised it as an issue in the repository. And the maintainer's like, what are you doing with this? Like, this is mad. Like, why are you using this with so many pods? There's definitely too many examples of that. Yeah, exactly.
You know you've made it when the maintainers go, we need to talk.
Yeah, I still remember early on when we had like questions from the Nginx people like, you seem to have stuff with traffic. Can we can we have this new feature? Can we like make sure it works?
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Cool. Because we're already over time, I need to cut this a bit short, but great insight. I mean, you really gave us a good run of the entire thing you're running there, and it's hugely impressive. It's very nice to see something like lots of quotes for me in there. If I talk to potential customers or other people, like what is possible? And I think you're one of the people that proved like Kubernetes is prime time, and like for however reliable you need it, it works. So thanks a lot, Miles. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, it's been great.
I'll cut us off here and wish you a great rest of the week. Looking forward to meeting you in person sometime, and we'll have a beer. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Miles.
Take care.